It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, speaking two languages is becoming more common in the United States, and the author of a new book says that has a lot of benefits for the country and for the people who are bilingual. We'll talk with him about the upside of learning more languages and get tips on learning that new language, no matter how old we are. First, it's been more than a week since a leak from an oil pipeline off the coast of California was first detected. Beaches have been closed, and a cleanup effort for both the environment and local wildlife is underway. A spill is one of the great fears with any pipeline above or below water. We're going to get the latest now from California, then look closer to home at the Enbridge Line 3 project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How closely have you been following Line 3 or Line 5 in the Midwest? Is this something that you are focused on, maybe worried about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Earlier today, I talked to Hannah Fry, Metro reporter covering Orange County for the Los Angeles Times. Hannah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, for people here in the Midwest following this story from afar, can you bring us up to speed on the basics and what's happened over the last week?
Yeah, so really this got started last Friday evening, and that's when a boater first noticed kind of a sheen on the water off the coast of Huntington Beach. So what happened was they reported this, and satellite imagery showed without certainty, but with a high likelihood that there was petroleum in the water. Now, the Coast Guard couldn't confirm this until early Saturday morning. And so that's really when, by about Saturday afternoon, the public was notified there's an oil spill off the coast of Orange County. It's probably going to be coming ashore fairly soon. The early estimates were that it was going to come ashore Monday. As we know, that did not come to pass. It ended up coming ashore really early Sunday morning.
Can you set the scene for us? What is it like when this oil spill is showing up on a local beach, a local shoreline?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the beach. In the case of this oil spill, Huntington Beach has really been the hardest hit. So what reporters on the ground were seeing were kind of these ribbons of oil on the sand. Other beaches have seen kind of tar patties, these big splotches of oil and tar washing up on their beaches. So it really depends on the stretch of sand that you're on.
What's the ecological threat, the biggest worry, I guess, at this point?
You know, I think there's a lot of worries, and there's some, you know, ecological threats that we're not going to see, you know, the full picture of, I think, for weeks and weeks. Some environmentalists are saying, you know, over the course of months. Right now, we've seen quite a few oiled birds. I think they have recovered 65 oiled birds as of yesterday morning. 38 of those were dead when they were recovered. There's also been 9 fish that have washed up dead as a result of this oil spill. And that's just, you know, over the course of the last week.
Talking to Hannah Fry. She covers Orange County for the Los Angeles Times, getting the latest on an oil spill from a pipeline, an underwater pipeline. What do we know, Hannah, at this point about what caused this leak?
So there's still a lot of unanswered questions surrounding what prompted this leak. What Coast Guard officials are saying right now is that they believe the pipeline was clipped by an anchor. They're not sure when that happened. The latest on that was they're looking at a period that could go back months, if not a year. So initially, they believe the pipeline was struck by an anchor and was displaced, but that the leak probably didn't start at that moment. It could have started later with another anchor strike, or just kind of environmental corrosion, wear and tear on the pipeline then later caused it to leak. But they're still really trying to pinpoint when that leak started and what caused that leak.
When I think of pipelines under salt water, I guess I think of the Gulf Coast and Louisiana and places like that. Apparently, you also have them in California. What are these pipelines running from and to?
So these pipelines, especially this one, this is running from the Port of Long Beach, which is just north of Orange County, out into an offshore oil platform, and it's called ELLI. And so these send, you know, oil from these platforms to the port.
What do we know about the company's response? When did they find out about this spill? How quickly did they respond?
So there's a lot of uncertainty around that. The company is saying that they learned about this spill shortly after 8 a.m. on Saturday morning. That's when they realized there was oil in the water. Now, federal regulators have said that an alarm was going off in their control room as early as 2:30 in the morning. So it's really unclear when they learned about this and how quickly the pipeline was shut down. I believe the latest we reported was that it took about 3 hours to shut down that pipeline.
How much oil has spilled? And I understand that estimate has changed over time.
It has. It's changed. It's varied wildly, actually. So right now they're saying as little as 24,000 or as much as 131,000 gallons. So it's a huge range, and that's something that I think is going to take quite some time for them to figure out.
What does a cleanup effort for something like this look like?
Oh, there's thousands of people working on this. There's people cleaning along the beach, carrying shovels and bags and picking up, clumps of oil and tar balls, and putting them in. So far, I think they've gathered about 250,000 pounds of oily debris from the shoreline from Huntington Beach to down to San Diego County. And then they're also cleaning up by vessel. So they've deployed booms to kind of contain the oil in the water, and then allow vessels to kind of suck up and clean up that oil. And I think they've gathered about 5,500 gallons of crude oil by sea.
Now, it's still early days, but is there a conversation about accountability if somebody's going to be held liable and have to pay for damages here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question on a lot of people's minds as this unfolds. Who's to blame, and what were the early hours of the response? Could it have gone better? Could it have been faster? I think these are all things that the investigators are going to be probing.
And then are there thoughts as to, hey, we've got these pipelines down there. Are we doing enough to, I guess, maintain them, make sure an anchor that hit them, say, 8 months ago or whatever, isn't getting ready to cause a leak tomorrow?
Yes, from what I understand, there's a lot of anger, I think, among some residents who, understand that California is rooted in oil production, and that's the past, and really would like to see the state and the country overall move away from this type of use. So I know that this incident has renewed those calls among environmentalists and some politicians as well.
As we wrap up, Hannah, what are you watching for next on this story?
I think we're keeping an eye on what's coming out of this investigation and looking at, what happened in the first early hours of this incident, and also, monitoring the cleanup effort and just seeing how long it's going to take before the beaches are brought back to their natural beauty.
Hannah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hannah Fry is a Metro reporter covering Orange County for the LA Times. We talked to her about an investigation into an oil spill over a week ago off the shores of Huntington Beach and how the cleanup is going. Coming up, we'll talk to Duluth Superior Region reporter about Enbridge oil pipeline projects that affect us here in the Midwest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following Enbridge's Line 3 or Line 5 projects and the protests and lawsuits surrounding them? What questions do you have about where they are now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now about energy pipelines. Earlier, we caught up on the spill and cleanup effort in California off Orange County. Now we're going to look closer to home with pipeline projects in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. Brooks Johnson covers Duluth for the Star Tribune. Brooks, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, the big story now, the big development is the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline. We'll dig into the history of that a little bit soon, but it is, as I understand it, Brooks, up and running now. Is that right?
It is. Oil has begun flowing through the pipeline, which begins in Alberta and carries tar sands oil, a very thick, heavy crude oil, into the U.S. through North Dakota, Minnesota, and a little bit of Wisconsin to Enbridge's terminal in Superior.
Talk about some of the history and controversy, if you will, about Line 3. What did it take to get here?
More than 6 years of regulatory process, protests, lawsuits, and most recently, 9 months of construction in Minnesota. So the 340 miles of pipeline across Minnesota was the last to be completed. The Canadian stretch and then the parts of North Dakota and Wisconsin were completed several years ago. There were many holdups in the state, including just a lengthy permitting process, several lawsuits launched by environmental and indigenous activists, opponents of the pipeline. And generally, it's been a long time coming for the company. Enbridge says, you know, the pipeline is necessary to more safely transport oil across the state. The company already has six pipelines that cross Minnesota. And it says that Line 3 is a replacement for a 50-year-old pipeline. And they say it's a needed safety improvement. Opponents, of course, say that any fossil fuel infrastructure should not be built in the face of climate change.
And we were just talking about this spill in California. Is that a concern raised by opponents of the line, the risk of a spill, maybe not today, maybe not in a year, but down the road sometime?
Absolutely. I mean, that's been the focal point of protests over Line 3 over the years, is that, you know, you're putting very sensitive wetlands, especially Minnesota and in northern Minnesota where it crosses, at risk of oil spills. There have been spills in Minnesota, and there was a major one in southwest Michigan in 2010 involving pipelines. And so, you know, opponents have said, you know, we can't risk spilling. And this pipeline, the replacement, the Line 3 replacement, actually crosses in part a new stretch of the state instead of following the existing corridor where pipelines are crossing now. So opponents have said this opens a new part of the state to potential environmental degradation. Enbridge's response is that, you know, if we were just to continue operating Line 3 as is, you know, it presents a higher risk of spill because it's needed increased maintenance in recent years.
You've at the Star Tribune, there's been reporting on some damage to an aquifer. Now, a leak, not an oil leak or a natural gas leak, but a water leak involved in the production process. What happened?
Yeah, so this happened in January, actually. An aquifer was punctured near Clearwater, Minnesota. And so this artesian groundwater has been welling up for more than 8 months, which has wasted about 24 million gallons of water. And it's threatened to dry out two rare and protected wetland areas called fens. And so this breach, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources revealed a problem last month, and it is ordering Enbridge to pay $3.3 million for the damage and give it 30 days to stop, essentially to cork the aquifer to stop the flow of water.
We're talking about pipelines in the Midwest, oil pipelines. Brooks Johnson is with us for the Star Tribune. You can join in with your thoughts and questions. Have you been following the story of these Enbridge pipelines, supporting them in your community, protesting them maybe? What questions or thoughts do you have on the need for pipelines? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, with Line 3, Brooks, you mentioned it's a new pipeline replacing an existing one, and the route changed somewhat. What went into that decision to move it in a slightly different direction?
Yeah, part of that was to avoid crossing Red Lake Band of Ojibwe land, which the existing corridor does now cross. That's about in the north central part of the state in Cass County, and so that was a major part of it. You know, the Enbridge has said, you know, it's been working with tribes all along to try to satisfy, you know, environmental concerns, and you know, has hired tribal resource folks to come out and watch construction. And so that all was in response, of course, to indigenous protests and folks who have been involved all along. But the route itself, as approved by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission last year for the final time, did reflect concerns of crossing treaty territory and a reservation.
As you mentioned, this was years in the making, protests, lawsuits along the way. Now that it's up and running, are there still lawsuits out there trying to stop it, or is this just pretty much a fact of life now?
Well, there's one federal lawsuit remaining that's in DC actually, and so folks are suing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers over its water and wetlands permit that were granted for Line 3's construction. So there is still a chance that this gets a closer look. We've seen a similar situation happen with Dakota Access. But essentially, you know, pipeline opponents had hoped that their suits and their actions, protests would get President Joe Biden's attention and say, you know, follow up on your climate promises. But the federal government has continued its support for the permit and is defending it in court.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jay is on the line in Two Rivers. Jay, hi.
Good afternoon. Given the hundreds of millions of tax dollars that we have given the hugely profitable oil industry over the decades, I'm wondering if these subsidies would be better put toward monitoring oil flow and increasing the number of valves and automatic systems, because it seems every time there's an oil spill, wherever it is, huge amounts of oil pollute either the land, the rivers, or our other water bodies. And here in Wisconsin, I know my city of Two Rivers relies on Lake Michigan for its fresh water, as do so many others. And given that it's Indigenous Peoples Day here in Wisconsin, I think we'd be much better served if we would transfer these subsidies away from the oil industry and give it to the original Americans, because we're still using their land to transfer the oil over.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Brooks. First of all, safety precautions, the kind of shutoffs and leak detection measures that Jay was talking about there. What does the company say about the safety measures they have in place, especially on a new pipeline like the new Line 3?
Yeah, well, of course, they say that they have state-of-the-art controls and monitoring on it, and they've also built a new Line 3 with a thicker pipe, so it's far less likely to rupture at all. As per the specifics of monitoring and such, it's what Enbridge says is the very best they can do. And a lot has been talked about Line 5, which runs in part through the Straits of Mackinac. And so that's another Enbridge pipeline that runs from Superior into Ontario, in part through the UP and into Michigan. And so there is a battle there going on about potential damage to the Great Lakes from an oil spill. And so that's been very closely watched.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jay. Jay also brought up some of the money angles. I don't know if one of these pipelines is going through my town or my county or tribal lands. Does somebody get paid for that? I don't know how that works at all.
Yeah, easements are negotiated with landowners along the route, and that happens sort of as part of the permitting process. What's also going to happen is that the old Line 3 is going to be decommissioned, meaning it'll be cleaned out and largely left in place, but landowners will be either paid to leave it in their land or have it removed at Enbridge's expense. The easements had to be bought and lined up well before any construction could begin.
Brooks, we've been talking mostly about Line 3. You just mentioned Line 5, which does have an underwater stretch. What is the latest on Line 5 right now? There are so many pipelines going on, it can be easy to lose track.
Right. This one moves about 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids between Superior, Wisconsin and Sarnia, Ontario, through parts of northern Michigan and Wisconsin. And right now it's sort of in a legal limbo. So Michigan governor has tried to shut down the flow of oil through the Straits of Mackinac, and that has been defied by Enbridge so far. And right now, Canada is backing its company, Enbridge, by invoking a treaty with the United States and asking a judge to suspend litigation over Michigan's effort to shut down that oil pipeline. So the battle continues. It's hard to say what's going to happen next, but it appears that there's going to be mediators and federal interventions happening now.
Well, now line three coming one way hits Duluth Superior. Line five comes out of Duluth Superior going the other way. People may not know that the Twin Ports there are such a big hub for oil distribution. Can you talk about how big a role they play?
It really is. Superior has an oil refinery, which, of course, in 2018 had a major fire, an explosion that and is still being repaired. But there's also, of course, a major Enbridge pipeline terminal that handles just millions and millions of gallons every day flowing from Canada down to refineries throughout the Midwest and beyond. And so the Superior does benefit from this in through state taxes, millions of dollars per year go into the city budget. And, you know, I've just taken a recent look through those budgets, and they've been able to keep property taxes pretty stable as a result. So no question that there is support for it locally, but at the same time, we're still seeing divisions that have been created by this project. I was driving across northern Minnesota just last week, and there are still pro and anti Line 3 signs dotting the highways.
In our last minute or so, Brooks, what are you watching for next on the pipeline beat?
Well, we got to see how litigation wraps up. And there is another suit that an interesting one that was filed in Whiter Tribal Court with Wild Rice as the lead plaintiff. So this is a rights of nature case that hasn't been tried in a tribal court before. But backers say that this gives the plant something that folks are looking to protect from oil spills, a voice and a chance for it to be protected.
Brooks, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Brooks Johnson. He covers Duluth for the Star Tribune. We talked to him today about the Line 3 pipeline of Enbridge, its impact on the landscape, and how we can compare the project to what we've seen from an underwater oil pipeline rupture off the coast in Orange County, California. We talked earlier to an LA Times reporter who's been following that story. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the benefits of being bilingual and get advice for learning a new language at any point in our lives. Our guest wrote a book about speaking more than one language. He busts a lot of myths, some of which I've believed in over the course of my life. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor with a focus on home inspection and what it means for buying and selling houses. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, how many languages do you speak? If the answer is one, you are not alone. You might think you've missed the window of opportunity to learn a second language as you got older, or that languages just aren't your strong suit. I have thought those exact things myself. But our next guest says no matter where we are in life, we can take on that challenge and join a growing number of bilingual Americans. He says it has big benefits for ourselves and for society as a whole. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you do speak more than one language, how did you learn two of them or three of them or four of them? Did you pick it up in childhood or later in life? What has speaking another language done for you? If you're monolingual, which language would be at the top of your list to learn? Do you think that the opportunity has passed you by? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Levine is the founder of the America the Bilingual Project and author of the new book, America's Bilingual Century, How Americans Are Giving the Gift of Bilingualism to Themselves, their loved ones, and their country. This Thursday, he's speaking at a free virtual event held by the UW-Madison Languages Institute. Find a link to that at wpr.org/centraltime. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Yes, thank you for that introduction. I'm delighted to be here.
I am inspired by your book because you grew up kind of like me. I didn't speak a second language. I had some shots at it. I fizzled and didn't pursue it. But you got there. What is it? Can you talk about your own journey to being bilingual, to adopting a second language?
Yes. Well, I guess I would describe my own language biography as failure to launch.
Sam.
In college, when I flunked my German proficiency exam. But it wasn't until much later in life, really at retirement age, that I decided to get serious about learning Spanish. And what happened is I would casually mention at a cocktail party, you know, people say, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm learning Spanish. And oh my gosh, if you want to have lively conversations at a, just mention that you're learning another language, because oh my gosh, people just opened up with pronouncements and complaints and things that really kind of threw me. For example, people would say, well, why bother? The whole world speaks English. Or why bother? We're going to have technology in our ears. We're going to do instant translation and we won't have to learn another language. But other people came up to me and they say, oh my gosh, how are you doing it? Because I really want to learn Italian. For some reason, people whisper when they want to know the secret. I got so many reactions and disparate reactions that I went back to school. I was a science writer early in my career, and I gave up my business career and went back to school and just studied bilingualism in the United States and worldwide. And what I found just kind of astounded me. First of all, because bilingualism is far larger in the United States than I knew, and I think that most Americans understand. And it's also far more diverse than really any other country, diverse in large quantities of speakers. And anyway, that's what I'm going to be showing. It's kind of hard to describe this in sure. words. The talk on Thursday is going to have data visualizations, which used to be called charts and graphs. Now it's called data visualizations, but it really deserves to be. It's a story that's not reported yet in the United States, is how big bilingualism is, the benefits of it, and how to be part of it.
Let's get to some of the how to be part of it. One thing I loved is, and I think about this, I've been doing a free app for Spanish for a couple of years now, and you see arguments, use this app, no, use this app, no, you got to take a class, no, you got to have immersion, whatever. Mm-hmm. What I love is you say, you know, different things might work for different people, but the key is, what place is it going to have in your life? Where are you going to find to use it? And that's going to motivate you to do whichever method. Talk about why that's so important.
Yeah. Well, when newcomers come to it, I know I did. The first question is, well, how should I do it? You know, should I use Duolingo or Rosetta Stone or Pimsleur, or what about a tutor? And by the way, I've done every method possible, including five tutors, that all of whom are in therapy now. But so here's the thing: all the methods are good. I haven't found a bad method out there, but the methods are only going to take you so far, and they're only going to give you so many hours. I mean, even if you're a nut on Duolingo, which is a great app, you're only going to amass a couple of hundred hours in that, in all likelihood. But to start to get comfortable in the language, we're really talking several thousand hours. And in order to do that, no matter how motivated you are as a learner, it's important to find where the language will live in your life. Where will your adopted language live in your life? And don't be put off that you have to figure this out right away. But eventually, you're going to want to know, like if it's Italian, that are you going to be studying opera in Italian? Are you, not that you're a singer, but are you going to be reading about opera in Italian? Are you going to go to Italy every summer? Have you married into an Italian-speaking household? These are all ways that can provide the why for you. And the whys are quite important.
Talking to Steve Levine about his new book, America's Bilingual Century. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to talk about the languages you speak. Is that exactly one, like pretty much still me, even after a couple years of trying? or two or three or four. What's your language story? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Hey, Willem.
Hi. I'm an immigrant to this country, and I immigrated with my family to Holland, Michigan. And when we did that, there were still like Dutch church services, and we spoke Dutch in our home. And so I speak Dutch and English. And I think that what was interesting about how quickly we picked it up as children, I have two brothers and a sister, and we all picked it up fairly quickly through going to school and I think, you know, having people help us and stuff. So we could speak English before my mother could really understand English well, which was sometimes useful and entertaining. But if my father was around, he spoke four languages, so we couldn't pull that on him. But I just think it's interesting. If you speak another language, you realize there are terms and words and phrases that are that you can't translate, really. They don't translate into English. So that's like so how language reflects culture sometimes, that, you know, cultural things occur that aren't, you know, transmittable by other languages.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. Steve, we could do a lot with that call. One is, it's a different way of thinking about the world if you can think and talk in another language, right?
Absolutely. And Willem is right about opening up the culture in a way that nothing else can. And I'm so happy to hear his language biography that he, and it sounds like maybe his siblings too, have kept up their Dutch, because, you know, the old American narrative is that our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents came to this country and purposefully did not pass on their heritage language to their children. Well, and it's because they were patriotic and Americans and happy to be here. And I'm sure that's all true. It's also true that they were practical. And back before 1960, it wasn't practical to go back on a steamship to the home country. Mm. And communication technology to the home country were handwritten letters. And the jobs that were available to themselves and their children were primarily English-speaking jobs because they were local jobs. Well, fast forward to today, where you can get back to the home country, in Holland in this case, quite easily, absent a pandemic, on airliners. And communication technology, well, I won't go into that. We all know what has happened beyond the handwritten letter. And the jobs that are available today, not just with the big corporations like the Googles and the Amazons and the Lyfts of the world, but even in small and medium-sized businesses are increasingly global and international. So today, it's practical for immigrant parents to pass on the language to their children. And it's not just immigrant parents and children, it's all Americans who are realizing the benefits of bilingualism and also realizing that we can be proud and loyal Americans by speaking English. You know, what I say, English is what unites us. Our other languages are what strengthen us and define us.
Thanks for the call, Willem. We're talking to Steve Levine, founder of the America, the Bilingual Project, author of the book America's Bilingual Century, talking to him about the benefits of speaking multiple languages and how to get started with learning a second one, even if you think you're terrible at it, like me. Call 800-642-1234. Were multiple languages part of your family, your household growing up? Did you learn a second language in adulthood? How did it go for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Steve Levine, author of the book America's Bilingual Century. He'll be speaking at a virtual event through UW-Madison's Language Institute this Thursday. We're looking at the benefits of bilingualism and how to learn another language at any age. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your stories, maybe your questions about language learning and bilingualism in the U.S. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Sabina is with us in Milwaukee. Sabina, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, it resonated what this program is about for me. My parents were immigrants, my father from Hungary, my mother from Germany. They met here in Milwaukee, and they were older when they emigrated, so they retained their language and their culture, and these are languages we spoke at home. But that was really unusual, as pointed out at the time. All of our immigrant friends, they spoke English with their kids, and it was kind of different and strange, but it was what we did at home. It opened a world up to us. My siblings and I, we could go to Europe, communicate with our relatives who didn't speak English. It led to me working in ESL and meeting people from many cultures in many places, and I think there's an expression, the Hungarian, how many languages you speak, it's how many people you are. And I think by that, I mean, it just really develops you and grows you as a person and really opens the world up to you. And I've passed this on to my daughter as well. I find it really extremely enriching for individuals, from starting with the language to the culture, the travel, and everything. And really, it's something that I think should be part of the curriculum from the very beginning of education, so everyone can learn a second language.
I love it, Sabina. Thank you so much. I think that exact quote you use in your book, Steve, I don't want to start a new Balkan war. I think you attribute it as a Czech saying, but it still holds, right?
Yes. Well, what a lovely story from Sabina and her language biography. And again, I'm delighted to hear that she has not only kept the language alive in her own life, but passed it on to her daughter. And she mentioned school curriculums and how they should include this. There's a lot of good news going on in that area. There's been a tremendous growth in what are called dual language schools, where they teach half the day in English and half the day in some other language. And whether that's Spanish or Mandarin or what have you. And it's really just a wonderful gift to give to children, because they end up being stronger in English, believe it or not, and also more academically proficient, and they graduate their classes being bilingual. There's also something called the Seal of Biliteracy, which Wisconsin has, where students can earn a seal on their diploma and their electronic transcripts that tells universities and employers that they have real proficiency reading and writing in another language besides English. And that's something that didn't exist just 10 years ago. So there's been a lot of changes in the school system. The Milwaukee School Board is lucky to have a fellow named Tony Baez on the board who's led a lot of changes. So yay for Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sabina, at 800-642-1234. We go now to Jerry in Johnson Creek. Jerry, hi.
Hello. Hola. I am so excited to talk to you about learning a new language. I'm 73 years old. I didn't start this until 4 years ago. And if you knew how many hours a day I study, you'd lock me up. I just absolutely love it. It's so addicting and fun. I use many different methods to learn. Online courses, Duolingo, I love that. I do that every morning. Reading books, writing. I took 4 semesters of an online course at UW-Milwaukee. Wow. With a fabulous professor named Karen, and I'm starting a new course with her very shortly. When I started making errors and laughing at myself, that's when I knew I was making progress. And it is so much fun to be able to talk to people. We're going to Oaxaca in December. Wow. And Puerto Vallarta in February. And you just cannot learn or know a culture until you know the people's language. And when you go to another country and you speak their language, they just light up. It's absolutely amazing.
Jerry.
I just wanted to say it's one of the most exciting things I've ever done in my life.
I love it. I love the enthusiasm. I'm inspired, Steve. How about you?
Yes. And Jerry, I'm just a few years behind you in your bilingual adventure. And boy, what a wonderful story. And you point out, I think, an important point, which is that people think of language struggle, language study as a struggle. Mm. because maybe our classes back in the day were a struggle. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. It can be a joy every step of the way. It doesn't mean it won't be without frustration, but when you're frustrated and when you're struggling is when you learn the most. And good language teachers will let you struggle, right? I mean, you may have experienced that. And the struggling is when you're learning, and you'll have other times where it's just easy and flowing and you have these breakthroughs that are aha moments. And I'm so happy to get your call, and you're living proof that you're never too old to adopt a language and to live the larger life that you were meant to do.
Jerry, thank you so much for sharing that. But Steve, Jerry makes me think of an obstacle that I have, and I assume I'm not alone. It's like, okay, I'm doing the Spanish thing too. I'm going to lay some Spanish on Jerry. And then the panic comes, and like my heart rate goes up, and I lose all of it. Like that anxiety, I assume, I hope other people have it. I'm not the only one. How do we get past that?
Well, here's a little trick I use. I say, estoy aprendiendo español. Me puede ayudar, and ayudarme, which means I'm studying Spanish. Will you help me?
Okay.
And once you say that, they, of course, they're going to help you, and you have a wonderful conversation. Yeah, because it can be embarrassing if you rattle off a good sentence and then they turn on the fire hose, and then you're kind of like what? Duh.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, thanks again for that call, Jerry. That was very inspiring at 800-642-1234. Talking to Steve Levine about his book, America's Bilingual Century. Can you talk a little more, Steve, about the societal benefits of more of us are learning extra languages, not just what's in it for us as individuals, what's in it for us overall?
Sure. On a national level, you know, linguistic capital is part of our human capital. And it is what allows us to first hear the world, listen to the world, and then to not just compete in the world. You know, there's an expression which is, if you want to buy something, you can do that in your language. But if you want to sell something, you can probably finish that. You better do it in the language of your customers, because if you don't, your competitors will. And by the way, when I say selling something, I don't mean just stuff like, you know, soft drinks and automobiles. I mean ideas and persuading. And it's not just competing, it's collaborating effectively. And, you know, people who say the whole world speaks English, well, my answer to that is you're right if you're a tourist. And being a tourist is an important thing. I hope we all get to be tourists again. Tourism is great for the economy. It's great for the tourists, et cetera. But it's not the most important thing humans do when they travel internationally. In all of the professions, whether it's diplomacy and development or in medicine or law or in business, unless you have professional level language skills, you're just not going to be competitive. You're just not going to be able to collaborate on a professional level. So the United States already, as I mentioned, is very strong in our international, in our linguistic capital, but we are on an exciting inflection point where people like Wilhelm and Sabina and Jerry and their children have understood that being bilingual is a patriotic act, and it's something they want, it's a gift they want to pass on to their children. And yes, it helps our country immensely in internal communications, and even more importantly, external communications. It's such a big part of our soft power.
Steve, so many callers on the line that came in the home stretch. We'll have to do this again sometime, I think. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
What a pleasure, Rob, and good luck on your journey. Buena suerte.
I need it. Thank you. Gracias. That's Steve Levine, founder of the America the Bilingual Project and author of the book America's Bilingual Century, How Americans Are Giving the Gift of Bilingualism to Themselves, Their Loved Ones, and Their Country. He'll be speaking this Thursday at 4 at a free virtual event through UW-Madison Language Institute. We've got a link up. You can find more info on that over at WPR.org/Central Time. Still time to share your stories of bilingualism or your efforts to get there on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, from Spider-Man to the Avengers, there are a lot of Marvel comics. Our guest says he's read them all. We'll meet the author of the new book, All of the Marvels, That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's not every day that I learn about a kind of produce I've never heard of before, but yesterday was one of those days. Some background, I do one of those CSA, community-supported agriculture things where you kind of subscribe to a farm for produce for a season. Yesterday, I got the last installment of the year, the big fall produce bonanza, lots of potatoes and squashes and leeks and more. And in a box was this really big, wide, squat pumpkin, and it was heavy and clearly dense. It was like maybe 20 pounds, kind of a butternut squash color. So big, I figured it was decorative, so I was ready to put it on the front porch. But wait, I checked the notes from the farm. It is intended for eating. It's called a Long Island cheese pumpkin, aka Long Island cheese squash. Does it taste like cheese? I don't know yet, but I plan to find out. Word on the street is you can use it kind of like butternut squash, or it makes a really good pumpkin pie. The tricky thing is how I'm going to cook it down. Usually I'd cut a squash or pumpkin in half and kind of bake and steam it, but half this dude is still really big. It would take forever to cook through, I think. I will keep you posted on my experiments with the Long Island cheese pumpkin of destiny. If you've got some advice, I would happily take it. Help me out. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. It's pumpkin news you can use. This is Central Time.